Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the Disability, Diversity and Inclusion Lessons Learned from the Industry Leaders Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. To ask a question during the Q&A session, you will need to press star one on your telephone. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. And please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the conference over to your speaker today, Peter Berg, with the Great Lakes ADA Center. Thank you. Please go ahead, sir.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome everyone to the February ADA audio conference session. As we heard, this session will focus on disability, diversity, and inclusion, lessons learned from industry leaders. The ADA audio conference series is a program of the National ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability Independent Living and Rehabilitation Research. You can reach your ADA Center by calling 800-949-4232, or you can locate your ADA Center by visiting adata.org. So welcome again to everyone across the country. We are pleased that you have joined us for today's session as we are rapidly approaching the 30th anniversary of the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act this coming July the 26th. So today's session, as I mentioned, will look at some research that was done by our speakers today. With us today, we have Rob Gould, who is an assistant clinical professor, as well as Sarah Parker-Harris, who is a associate professor, both with the University of Illinois Chicago, Department of Disability and Human Development, and part of the Great Lakes ADA Center research team. And then also joining us today is Courtney Mullen. Courtney is a PhD candidate in the Disability Studies Program at the University of Illinois Chicago, Department of Disability and Human Development. So we are pleased to have our presenters with us today. There's going to be an opportunity for you to ask questions at the end of their presentation. For those of you participating in the webinar room, remember you can submit your questions while the presentation is ongoing. And for those of you on the telephone, jot your questions down, and when we get to the question and answer portion, we will bring our operator, Lovely, and that is her name. I will ask her to come back and give instructions again for our phone participants. All right, you've heard far too much from me today, so I would like to, at this point, turn it over to Rob, Sarah, and Courtney. So welcome, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Peter, and to the Great Lakes ADA Center for hosting this webinar, and also thanks to everyone who has joined us on the call today. I am on slide 14. Just to talk through the agenda of what we're going to talk about in today's session, we're going to go through briefly key policies that support disability employment and look at some recent research on disability in the workplace. This is to provide context to the study that we're going to talk about, which is looking at the business case for disability inclusion. We're going to present on some findings from research on organizational strategies that position disability as diversity. And then finally, we're going to end with some discussion and recommendations for practice. And then we'll have an opportunity for questions at the end. I am on slide 15. I'm going to provide an overview of the project. This project is one of four research projects on ADA implementation as part of the ADA Great Lakes Center research projects. The goal of the project is to improve understanding about organizational factors that lead to excellence in ADA compliance, implementation, and disability programming. The project that we're going to speak about today has two steps. The first step was reviewing corporate social responsibility reports, and the second step was qualitative interviews with organizations. And these interviews will remain anonymous, but we will be presenting the results in their own words from the interview. The purpose of the project is to identify how leaders in the region recruit, support, and retain people with disabilities, and this is in the Great Lakes region. It's to explore how disability is approached in diversity and inclusion efforts, and to understand how lessons are learned and key takeaways for businesses interested in inclusion efforts. We have a quote from one of our qualitative interviews that really sums up the purpose of why we started to do this project. In their own words, a quote from the interview: "Too many times it is viewed that diversity inclusion is about gender and race and ethnicity or whatever, but that disability is not seen in some ways. It's not even brought to the table. As you look at the workforce that's coming up, there is not a lot of people, and we all know that disability is the largest gapped, untapped resource that's out there. So I believe that larger companies, maybe even medium size, are at least starting to think about it and looking at where they're going to find that talent." I'm going to hand over to Rob now, who is going to talk through the methodology of our program.
And moving on to slide 16. Thank you, Sarah. So I want to start by going over the methodology a little bit about how we addressed this larger problem and approached the central purpose of exploring the goal of this project. We started with two core research questions to guide our research. The first is, how is disability included in broader diversity efforts? And the second is, what strategies do organizations use to implement and promote disability as a component of diversity? Our methods, our research project, had two stages, as Sarah mentioned. The first was a review of corporate social responsibility practices. Corporate social responsibility is the goal of businesses to look at the social and benefits of potential practices. To look at that, we looked at the public-facing reports, those that are often found on companies' websites, to look at how companies publicly look at their social responsibility strategies. We start with companies that scored 100% in the 2016 U.S. Business Leadership Network, which is now known as Disability In, Equality Index. The Disability Equality Index is a reporting mechanism that the national organization uses to rank companies based on their diversity and inclusion practice. Our study today uses the 2015 and 2016 corporate social responsibility reports, or the equivalent report that was available to the public. The second aspect of our study includes interviews with disability inclusion professionals. We looked to representatives of organizations that were recommended to us for disability inclusion efforts. Oftentimes, these recommendations were made by technical assistance experts within the ADA National Network. They are also recommendations of people involved with disability inclusion within the Great Lakes region. Next slide, moving on to slide 17. We're going to provide a little bit of broader context looking at the problems that led us to the research. There's a lot of information that we'll provide in terms of background, and we include some references at the end of the presentation. The goal is just to kind of give you a quick overview, as we recognize this is a very diverse audience. So we're happy to answer more questions in further detail at the end of the presentation or via email. One of the starting points, of course, to guide our research was the problem of disability employment in the U.S. People with disabilities participate in the labor force at a much lower rate compared to people without disabilities in the U.S. Based on the December 2019 statistics from the Kessler Foundation and the University of New Hampshire, approximately 77.3% of people without disabilities participate in the labor force. That's compared to people with disabilities who are only 33.3%, obviously a notable gap. People with disabilities are also more likely to be underemployed than people without disabilities, as almost twice as many people with disabilities have part-time employment. Employment continues to be a major issue for people with disabilities and a central point of advocacy and related policy. Next slide, please. On page 18, the focal point of advocacy has often started with social policy to promote workplace workforce inclusion. Several policies have been developed to address these disparities related to disability employment, as well as match the goals of advocacy to promote disability inclusion in the workforce. Three core policies that relate to our central project include Title I of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or the ADA, which prevents discrimination on the basis of disability. It also is used to secure reasonable accommodations within the workplace. Employment First policies are often state-led initiatives that draw on multiple strategies to encourage community-based and competitive employment for people with disabilities. 40 states now have employment first policies or legislation, which tend to dictate that employment is the first option for people seeking services within a state system. There's a wide variation of what these policies look like in practice, and oftentimes they've reflected the grassroots advocacy of various advocates throughout the disability community across the United States. A third key policy that reflects this larger goal to promote disability employment is the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which enhances regulations on activities done by state systems to encourage competitive employment outcomes for people with disabilities. This largely has impacted integrated employment through the workforce development system, as well as vocational rehabilitation systems. We're moving to slide 19. There's a number of impacts of these policies and areas of a concern that really beg the need for research to better locate ways to strategize more inclusive practices to support disability employment. There's a number of implementation barriers associated with these policies and the related research in related to actually identifying ways to move towards best practice. First off, we know that oftentimes there's been a focus on just complying with the law rather than moving beyond compliance and changing the very cultures to create more inclusive environments to support people with disabilities. Even nearing 30 years since the passage of the ADA, there continues to be widespread misunderstandings of accommodations as rights as special treatment. Even though it's not possible to really generalize or understand how prevalent these feelings are, there still continue to be case law looking at the examples of disability rights being misunderstood as special rights. Traditionally, focus and research and practice has looked at training individuals, or what's called the supply side of employment, rather than looking at the larger employment environment, what is largely called the demand side of research, to explore market needs and skill sets that employers want in employees. Moving to the next slide, slide 20, there's a number of trends that is growing to support this larger push towards a more inclusive workplace. Supporting disability inclusion takes a number of different areas and different areas of research to understand best practices. There's a growing body of research that's shifting towards identifying business practices that enhances disability inclusion rather than just focusing about individual attributes, what individuals need to do better. Some of the commonly reported practices that are linked to inclusive workplaces, including flexible management, a willing to change and alter the work environment as needed to accommodate employees, an understanding of workplace accommodation, enacting the social goals of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is the larger promise of disability inclusion, does require certain knowledge about the practices that make it possible. Some of the ways to really promote that more cultural and social aspect of disability inclusion include various employee engagement initiatives, actually getting buy-in from the various employees, especially those with people with disabilities, tends to be one of those aspects that is seen as leading towards more inclusive workplace. Diversity training tends to be an increasingly recognized area of supporting disability inclusion, although recent research has shown disability is often left out of such training. In fact, there have been very few trainings specifically developed to support disability inclusion. And the last aspect of common research trends that we've seen is top-level buy-in, which will be a major theme in today's presentation. I'd like to transition and hand it over to Courtney Mullen, who will talk a little bit about disability and its relation to organizational culture.
Hi, thanks, Rob. This is Courtney. I just wanted to address a quick question that came in. So there's a question about the statistic on slide 17, and if that included both white-collar and blue-collar jobs. Yes, that was a statistic about all labor force participation. So moving back on to the slide that we're on now, on slide 21, so disability and organizational culture. Disability inclusion tends to fall under the broader umbrella of diversity and inclusion initiatives. And both of these are complex concepts that are impacted and influenced by organizational culture and other practices. Diversity relates to the differences in experiences, thoughts, and demographics of employees. So looking at all of the attributes that make employees unique. Inclusion, on the other hand, is the degree of which an employee perceives that he or she is an esteemed member of the working group and experience treatment that satisfies their need for belongingness and uniqueness. So really feeling like they are valued for their unique perspectives and they belong within that workplace culture. So a quick statistic for you is disability is often not considered part of diversity inclusion efforts. However, 82% of the sampled organizations from our research did include disability within their diversity and inclusion statements. However, this may be somewhat biased since we only looked at organizations that had received accolades for their disability inclusion efforts. And so while disability is increasingly becoming a focus of business diversity and inclusion initiatives, it's often still overlooked as a dimension of diversity. So next slide. Now on slide 22, so we're shifting towards disability as part of diversity. And there's three main reasons that have been identified in the research as reasons that businesses have disability inclusion initiatives. The first is compliance with public policies, such as the ones that Rob just described. However, complying with regulations has been shown to have a limited effect on human resource or other business practices. Another reason that businesses have disability inclusion is because of social responsibility. So the public is increasingly expecting businesses to act in a responsible manner, and disability inclusion is seen as the right thing to do by the public. And last, I'll talk about this a little bit more in the next slide, but there are expressed benefits of inclusion, and this is referred to as the business case for diversity and inclusion, where the benefits of having these strategies outweigh potential costs. And we'll go to the next slide, slide 23. The business case for diversity and inclusion is diversity is not just seen as a good thing to do, but it's recognized as good business. So diversity and inclusion strategies have been shown to increase customer bases. So the market value in supporting diverse employee base matches diverse markets that are available. There's also to recruit top talent and encourage innovative thinking. Disability groups are largely untapped as a source of innovation and can lead to out-of-the-box thinking. In the next slide, we discuss a few specific benefits that employers can have by including employees with disabilities. So one is employees with disabilities have been shown to have longer tenure, which directly relates to a decrease in turnover costs. And providing accommodations to employees with disabilities has been shown to increase productivity in the workplace, increase the likelihood of employees staying with the company, and improving employee morale and job satisfaction, which are both core tenets of employee engagement. So I'm going to send it back to Rob now to talk more through our methods and approach.
Great. Thanks, Courtney. We're moving to slide 26, please. I'll talk a little bit more about our methodology, even though I already gave a little bit of a sneak preview about this. We really took two formal steps within our research to start addressing these questions and explore the strategies that are being used to include disability within diversity. The first step is we did a review of strategies found in 34 publicly available CSR, corporate social responsibility reports, from companies that have received national rewards for their disability inclusion efforts. 88% of the sample were listed on the Fortune 500, and some of the most common industries included healthcare, aerospace, technology, financial services, and airlines. The vast majority of these businesses are headquartered in the U.S., and all the companies had more than 4,000 employees. The analysis of these reports helped guide our interviews and really understand the process of building inclusive workplaces. I'm moving to slide 27, please. As I mentioned, the process was really looked at in our second stage of our research, which included anonymous organizational interviews with representatives of 11 large organizations across the Great Lakes region. This includes Illinois, Minnesota, Ohio, and Wisconsin. All of our interviews were representatives of organizations that had at least 5,000 employees. A few background facts about the organizations that participated. All of them have a disability-based employee resource group, which we'll talk a little bit more in detail as one of our findings. Five of them actually have paid positions working specifically on disability inclusion. Nine explicitly include disability in their supplier diversity initiatives. Some of the industries represented within the sample include insurance, financial services, accounting and consulting, healthcare, as well as medical technology. The participants had a wide variety of roles within the organization. As we'll talk about, in fact, many of the interviewees actually had multiple roles. Very few of them had a full-time job of being a disability inclusion expert, or really even being a diversity and inclusion specialist as their only role. Our interviewees include human resources, diversity and inclusion, disability inclusion, as well as recruitment specialists. Collectively, each of these individuals were identified as understanding the process of disability inclusion across multiple aspects of their organization. If we can move to the next slide, slide 28, please, we'll hand it over to Sarah Parker Harris, who will talk about how businesses approach disability inclusion in practice.
Thanks, Rob. I am going to move to slide 29. So these are some of the commonly reported corporate social responsibility strategies that have been included in public reports. And I'm just going to go through some of the major categories of what's being done. Sorry, I was trying to type a response to the question at the same time as speak one, and I cannot type and speak at the same time. So I just wanted to come back to that question. I think it's important, and we're going to be talking through at the end about how organizations make sure they include disability in their diversity and inclusion statements without expressly asking if their employees, if they have a disability, without forcing their employees to disclose. Part of what we're showing and what I'm actually going to report on in the CSR strategies is we're showing that disability should be included as diversity along the same lines as any other category. So it's not requiring or even asking somebody to disclose or to self-identify. It should already be in there the same way that other diversity categories such as gender and race are included. So a company that may not even have people that self-identify as a person with a disability, good practice is still including disability as diversity in there. And some of the most commonly reported strategies that the organizations report, the two most reported at 68% is employee resource groups related to disability. So that means that organizations have employee resource groups, and we will talk about some examples of that next. And also that disability is included in diversity and inclusion sections. So the majority of companies actually report that regardless of knowing if their employees have a disability, they are included as a diversity category. And some of the other commonly reported strategies that companies do, they highlight disability inclusion awards, they work on supplier diversity initiatives, and also philanthropic giving and community partnerships. Some of the less common strategies that are still practiced by organizations that do report high on disability diversity strategies are listing disability benefit packages for employees, customer outreach and accommodation, targeted recruitment of prospective employees with disabilities, listing employee accommodation resources, and also disability-specific employee training. So I'm moving to slide number 30, and we're going to. This is focusing more on the organizations that we interviewed. So with the organizations that we interviewed, in terms of their main approaches to diversity and inclusion, I'm going to read out some of, in their own words, some of the quotes that the participants talked with us about. One of the organizations said, so disability is one of the big eight dimensions of diversity. And so that's one that we've woven into our diversity and inclusion strategy. And that quote talks to how disability, you don't need to identify people with disabilities in your organization to already include it as a strategy. All of the organizations that we interviewed have existing diversity and initiative, or D&I, infrastructure, and a specific commitment and effort towards supporting a diverse workforce. Disability in these organizations has been integrated into the broader diversity and inclusion efforts through the following ways: through corporate social responsibility planning, through employee groups and internal communications, broader diversity council initiatives, and through targeted recruiting. Three key strategies that were identified by all of the people that we interviewed included communities of practice, employee resource group, and senior leadership buy-in. And that's what we're going to be focusing on in the rest of the talk today. I'm going to hand over to Rob, who is going to talk through the first finding around community of practice.
So the first finding, looking at community of practice, is really speaking to one of three areas that our interviewees spoke to in the greatest depth, that we really feel like we have a good understanding, provide some practical ideas about what's being done to support these ideas in practice. Now, the first question is, what is a community of practice? In the next 9 slides, we'll go over some findings based on the input of our interviewees. We'll also give some brief quotes that support our analysis of these findings. Communities of practice are a fancy way of saying standing or ongoing resources for conversations about business needs and community partnerships. Often, these are business-to-business groups. In fact, almost all of our participants mentioned working with other businesses in similar industries or even different industries to identify partnerships for collaboration. Oftentimes in communities of practice, it might include other outside groups, such as advocacy organizations or independent living centers that are similarly working on inclusive disability strategies. Communities of practice often offer our ways and avenues for trainings, recruiting a more diverse workforce, as well as more formalized partnerships as well. There's a number of people who do participate in communities of practice. They can include external partners in similar industries, and many often have some sort of executive sponsor, which is some sort of senior leadership that is kind of representing an organization. Members often are part of multiple diversity groups, and the focus is on partnering with other regional groups to promote inclusive practices. We're going to move on to the next slide, please, slide number 32. So what does participating in a community of practice look like according to our interviewees? Oftentimes, communities of practice focus on learning and sharing with other companies to develop strategies, discuss best practices, as well as the common barriers to implementing some of these ideas that we talk about today. Oftentimes, they start with raising awareness and sharing resources as well, as there's been substantial research, as well as practical guidelines to understand the tenets of disability inclusion. There are increasingly more resources available, and community of practices were described as ways to learn from each other regarding disability inclusion, both how it's done in practice, as well as ways that companies often want to move forward. Oftentimes, communities in practice can work together to identify and bring experts to consult on disability-inclusive strategies, as it tends to be seen as a strategy that helps multiple businesses and not necessarily something that breeds competition. Oftentimes, communities in practice are able to share resources to tap into additional resources within the region to really enhance disability inclusion. For example, universities were one group that were mentioned with the vast majority of our participants as sources of partnership, knowledge, as well as recruitment pipelines for more diverse talent. Oftentimes, bridging between disability providers is often a way to actually build and identify new ways of recruiting people with disabilities. We provided some examples of the communities of practice that were mentioned by our participants. The first is Disability In itself, which is a national organization devoted to promoting disability and inclusion as a good practice. It also included a number of local disability inclusion-related business groups, active partnerships between organizations, the National Organization on Disability, as well as local disability-related organizations, such as workforce development centers and vocational rehab providers. These were all examples that were talked about in depth to enhance disability inclusion in the workplace. Moving to the next slide, slide 33, please. One of the key examples that was provided by our sample was really understanding the benefits of why people really want to engage in these communities, as well as the immediate impact on their inclusive practices. The primary benefits detailed by the interviews including identifying as a starting point. Oftentimes, by looking to other leaders within the region, it started initial conversations about how to get to some new areas of growth. The idea was that this might be a better together approach, where oftentimes you can learn from other businesses, not necessarily reinventing good practices, when others have already demonstrated leadership in growing inclusion within their workforce. Another benefit is that it demonstrates an organizational commitment to disability inclusion. The establishment of a community practice, as well as getting a seat at the table, often can be a mechanism to raise awareness within the organization. A community of practice might be beneficial to client relations, as it organically can build networking opportunities, as well as a shared learning of best practices. I'd like to share a quote from one of our participants, which kind of gets to this idea of how you might benefit from a shared networking through the communities of practice. The quote one of our interviewees said was, "We have started doing some work around building our own training programs, but we've kind of paused that, waiting to see if there are other external organizations that have something to offer. That's where we go back to our link with the community of practice, perhaps something we can leverage from them." Oftentimes, this leveraging includes helping organizations prioritize and strategize on disability recruitment, the employee supports, as well as looking at customer outreach. Oftentimes, the supports that were seen to benefit for employees were also thought of ways to reach out to customers with disabilities as well. Communities of practice provide increased leadership and visibility and opportunities for additional training and ways to embrace passion. Many of our interviewees spoke about their passion about disability inclusion, often as a personal experience or that of a family member, or some greater goal within their personal life. This way to embrace passion has often been a starting point for engaging employees within larger communities or resource groups. Oftentimes, communities of practice were identified as a way to help with self-identification initiatives, where people tend to be more comfortable disclosing when there's a group of like-minded individuals that creates a culture welcoming of disability and diversity. The last point I want to touch on is last benefit might be providing a diversity of thought to company activities. Communities of practice offer opportunities for advocacy around accessibility and accommodations. A number of the interviewees we identified talked about communities of practice as ways to identify access needs within organizations and start internal advocacy, as well as shared community advocacy, to improve inclusive opportunities for people with disabilities. I'm going to turn it over to Courtney, who will talk about employee resource groups, which are often a way to build inclusive practices internally within a company.
Great. Thank you, Rob. So this is slide 34, and I'm going to be talking about our second main finding, which is employee resource groups, or ERGs. So what is an ERG? Sometimes they are known by other names, such as a business resource group or affinity group, but they are employee networks developed to support inclusion and learning related to various aspects of diversity within a company. So their structures and supports varied across the different interviewees. For example, some had centralized leadership, and others had direct support from their diversity and inclusion staff, and even some had fixed budgets for activities attached to their group overall. There were employee resource groups act as internal resources to inform, educate, and empower employees. And participation is often done in addition to regular job tasks. So this would be a position that's held in addition to a day job. The primary roles of employee resource groups include raising awareness of disability inclusion and activities within the organization. So spreading that internal awareness to employees who may not be already connected with the disability inclusion activity. And then employee resource groups also develop disability inclusion strategies. So some were described as developing strategic plans, making recommendations, or advising broader diversity and inclusion divisions or activities. And then other employee resource groups actually implemented these inclusion activities. And that could be seen as an example, such as awareness events, hosting trainings, such as a lunch and learn about a specified topic, or hosting meetups for various employees. Another primary role was advocating and modeling access. So many of the employee resource groups acted as a model for accessible features in meetings or buildings. So there's a quote to describe this. The ERGs are really trying to build advocacy from within the company itself. But then there's also connections. So the D&I area actually drives more in terms of what the company is doing from a marketing perspective and a recruiting perspective. So you can see how both the diversity and inclusion strategy in this is connected to the internal activities of the employee resource groups. If you could go to the next slide, please. So looking at slide 35, how and why do employees get involved with an ERG? So all of the companies that we interviewed or representatives we interviewed had an existing employee resource group structure, and disability-based ERGs are often newer than the other affinity groups. Membership, or people who are members of the ERG, were typically people with disabilities, family members or caregivers of people with disabilities, and allies. There were various incentives or supports offered for people who wanted to be involved, such as professional development and paid time to attend meetings. And then there was often a page or link on an intranet page within the company to raise awareness about the employee resource group, as well as the different activities and resources available. Additionally, most of the employee resource groups have a designated leadership, either through a rotating presidency or a leading committee or an executive sponsor of some kind. And there's another example from one of our interviewees. So there's many different reasons people get involved in ERGs. And I think the shift that we've seen over these 10 years is that ally component and having people just get involved because they want to learn more about the disability community and that people can do things in a different way and don't assume they can't do X, Y, and Z when they're interviewing because of a disability that's visible. And now I'll go on to the next slide. So what are the impacts of ERGs in the workplace? So members often host events such as training and awareness-raising activities. So the interviewees described how having these trainings about different topics was raising awareness about disability as well as giving practical advice to the people who attended those trainings. There's also a leadership opportunity to promote internal growth and networking. So for the members, there is an opportunity to have leadership roles and to network with others across the company. There's inter-organizational collaboration, such as reviewing key policies, plans, and data. So being able to kind of draw connections across the company that may not have otherwise been made without an employee resource group. There's also the benefit of being involved with plans or activities that are guided by company pillars or core values. So employee resource groups acted as a way to connect disability inclusion with overarching business strategies and showing that clear linkage between the two. And then finally, something that we found was the internal advocacy to improve disability inclusion efforts. So employee resource groups were one of the main vehicles to promote self-identification and accessibility initiatives throughout many of our interviews. So some of the descriptions of this from our interviewees was being a leader in the ERG means a lot of exposure to a lot of different executives, being exposed to a lot of different types of work that you might not get in your current job. You get a lot of different training and self-development opportunities. So that quote really highlights the benefits that members or leaders of ERGs get by participating in an employee resource group. The next quote is, we had each member of our senior leadership responsible for each one of our business resource groups. So it's at the very top level that they're pushing the agenda to make sure that the business resource group has the support, the tools, and the resource that it needs to continue to head out in that particular direction. But also, we're kind of relying heavily on the business resource group to a certain degree to kind of tell the firm what it is they should be doing, what we should be participating in, and where we should be. And that quote highlights how the employee resource groups act as a connection between top-down approaches, such as senior leaders setting agendas, and grassroots, so getting feedback from employees themselves about directions of different disability inclusion activities. So that ERG really acts as that connection piece. I'm now going to turn it over to Sarah to talk about our third finding.
So the third common finding across the organizations that we interviewed was the importance of senior leadership buy-in. So senior leadership buy-in is expressed support and participation in disability inclusive strategies from top-level senior leadership within the organization. All of the organizations that we spoke to strongly recommended the need for senior leadership buy-in for disability inclusion, because this can set the tone within the organization, and it can raise awareness of the disability inclusion issues. These are important for cultural changes within the organization. It can also ensure other members of the organization were committed to disability inclusion efforts, and gaining support and resources to accomplish disability inclusion activities. And these are important for systemic changes within the organization. Senior leadership involvement in the organizations that we spoke to included a variety of different ways that they could participate. Some of the main ways that the organization spoke about their senior leaders buying in to disability as diversity was executive sponsors of employee resource groups. Some senior leaders were assigned and others were volunteered because they had a personal connection, either themselves, a family member or a friend, or as an ally. Diversity councils or other groups comprised of senior leaders that help set strategic direction. Senior leaders participated in diversity inclusion activities. This could include such as self-identification campaigns. So if senior leaders do have a disability and wanted to self-identify, they could spearhead a self-identification campaign. Some of the organizations spoke about how this was very successful. Senior leaders participating in communities of practice, such as local disability inclusion strategies, the ones that Rob spoke about earlier, and also working as designated leader roles for disability inclusion, such as providing budgets, approving activities, spreading awareness, and providing direction on disability inclusive strategy. The importance of senior leadership buy-in does cross-cut the need for both cultural change within the organization. When senior leaders are part of the efforts, the culture of the organization can shift. And it's also important for systemic changes within the organization. To have that senior leadership buy-in means that resources and support is coming from the very top, which means that change can actually take effect. Moving on to the next slide, some of the people that we spoke to really agreed that it was particularly important for the senior leaders to be part of it. And in their own words, they said, I think that people can only be successful with top-down. I really do. I think you need to have the leadership support, the tone at the top, and I know these are all cliche phrases, but it's true. Having them push diversity and inclusion as something that's part of the core of the firm and our core values, those are the type of words we use. And I think the majority of the people at the firm believe in it as well. But it's because the top down has been so vocal on this topic. We're going to move on to discussion and recommendation, and I'm going to hand you back to Rob to take us through this.
And we're on slide 40 for those who are following along. we want to end with a little bit of discussion about the key takeaways about what it looks like and what can be done to better support disability inclusion in the workforce. Our discussion and recommendation are partly based on our own synthesis of the research, but also we asked each of our interviewees to share what they really thought were the best starting points, especially for those organizations that are just getting started off in their diversity and inclusion efforts to better support people with disabilities. We asked what were some things that really got organizations started in the right direction. Our sample was varied in that some were very well developed in their plans, and some were just getting started off and were actually having great success already. All in all, they did have some shared ideas about where to begin to build the necessary collaboration for disability inclusion. First and foremost, all of our groups discussed the power of business networking groups to share strategies and resources, oftentimes facilitated through advocacy organizations, public agencies, and businesses. By actually creating these conversations, not internally, not in silos, oftentimes shared information can be a conduit to building more inclusive spaces. Secondly, is having working groups and conferences on the regional and national level can enhance information sharing and thought leadership. While all of our findings and our synthesis is from the Great Lakes region, you'll notice that there's probably a lot of similarities to inclusive practices that are being seen on the national level. The third element of what can be done to better support disability inclusion is that partnerships and internal dialogue through development and the use of internal audit tools. Every one of our participants mentioned using some sort of audit as a discussion point to go through what already exists through policies. Sometimes it's actually identifying what exists, whether it's a diversity policy or perhaps a disability-specific practice, to look at that as a conversation point. Disability In, as well as the National Organization on Disability, include an equality index that has often been identified as a starting point for these sorts of conversations. Many of our participants talked about going through an internal audit process, looking at their internal disability processes as a conversation point that ultimately led to building a more inclusive organization. Last is to work with training and consulting on disability inclusive strategies, both by advocacy groups and other experts. None of our businesses or organizations mentioned doing it alone. Every single one of them mentioned the need to work with outside organizations when necessary to help understand evolving best practices. The next slide, we're moving on to slide 41. Some of the key recommendations that were provided by our interviewees can be read as kind of a roadmap about where one might begin with building a more inclusive organization. First is to start with the low-hanging fruit. Often just by joining a business-to-business network and starting with conversation with local communities of practice, it's an easy way to get these conversations started. It also might be eye-opening to see what local organizations are willing and available to support recruitment efforts of a more diverse workforce inclusive of people with disabilities. The second point is to start reviewing diversity and inclusion strategies. Is disability specifically mentioned, included alongside other aspects of diversity, inclusion, and identity? It was resounding amongst our interviewees that each of them mentioned that disability should be outright included next to each of these other aspects. Disability inclusion often is an ongoing and evolving process, but needs to be looked at similar to these other aspects of diversity. The next point that was recommended from our interviewees was to explore the business case for disability inclusion. Internal organization efforts often mirror external markets. There's a transformative potential of actually recruiting a more diverse workforce of people with disabilities, as there is a growing recognition of the purchasing power and largely an untapped market of people with disabilities. Having a more representative workforce has key customer benefits. Lastly is finding a balance to sustain the growth. All of these strategies don't need to be implemented at once, and in fact, oftentimes it takes some leadership that is in place to continue and pass on the torch when necessary. Find a champion, such as top-down leadership, is a great step, but don't let them be your only resource. Find a community partner and find a network to build that commitment, which is essential and only one part of the process. We want to wrap up with three quotes based on the recommendations of where to get started by the interviewees. The first participant said, "I think the most basic level, if an employer can get employees in similar situations together just to provide support to one another, I think that's a great start. I think that the ideal level, the most mature level, this needs to be integrated all across the employee life cycle, part of recruiting, part of the onboarding, part of the ongoing development, making sure the employees are aware of the support that's out there throughout their entire duration at the company." The second idea that was passed on was the idea about how you specifically can approach disability as an issue of diversity within the organization. It starts with, quote, "disability etiquette. I think that's something that a lot of people don't have, they don't grasp, they don't even know that they need to learn about it. And as much as you can raise awareness at your firm, make sure people are treated the way that they want to be treated. Teach people what that means, because a lot of time people mean well, so it's in my mind the best thing is that we start doing it, openly having conversations about differences and not making it a taboo. On the contrary, encouraging uncomfortable conversations take place." The last quote symbolizes the strategies about what the process looks like for actually getting to building a culture. How do we get connected and build that strong thought leadership? Best practice sharing, better understanding, because every organization is going to be built a little bit differently, and they're going to have their different approaches. But I'm a firm believer of understanding your organization well enough to know what's going to work well, what's not, and how do you infuse a little bit more of that stuff that's going to work well into your existing environment and slowly start to change culture in a positive way. I really want to end with that quote because I really think it takes the meaning of our presentation to a grand culmination. The process of how you get there in terms of building disability inclusion, what it looks like, really needs to be tailored to your organization. We know that the strategies we share today, such as a community of practice, formalized employee organizations, as well as top-down buy-in, are the key starts for many organizations. But of course, your individual organization is going to need specific tailoring to make this meaningful change for you. We'd like to end on slide 43. If you have additional questions, you can forward them to me. I'm the Director of Research for the Great Lakes ADA Center, Rob Gould. My email is on the slides provided, rgould3@uic.edu. The PowerPoints will be made available through the course link in your registration. Thank you all very much for joining us today. We will now have some time for some questions from the audience.
All right. Thank you, Rob, Sarah, and Courtney. I failed to mention this at the beginning. When I introduced you, I did not do a full introduction. You can view all of the speaker bios, Sarah, Rob, and Courtney's information on the audio conference website, ada-audio.org, and select speakers, and you can see their full bios. The other thing I wanted to mention was that the research used information contained from the Disability Equality Index from, I think, 2015-2016. October 2019 audio conference session was on last year's Disability Equality Index, so you can check out the archive of that session if you want more information about that. So I'm going to ask Lovely if you would rejoin us at this time and give our telephone participants instructions on how they can ask questions. Those of you in the webinar room, you can continue to submit your questions in the chat area. But Lovely, if you could give instructions for our telephone participants at this time, please.
Yes, sir. Again, as a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star and then the number one on your telephone keypad. To withdraw your question, press the pound key. Please stand by while we compile the Q&A roster.
Okay. While we wait, thank you for that, Lovely. While we wait for to see if we have any questions from our telephone participants. When I ask the questions, if whoever wants to handle the questions, just speak up and identify your yourself. I'm gonna, these are some questions that were submitted in advance. Actually, I'm going to pause there before I go on. There were some questions, Rob and Sarah, that were submitted as you were speaking and as Courtney were presenting. If you could take a moment now to go back to some of those questions that you responded to in the chat area, so that we can caption, so we can capture those through the captioner, and for the folks on the telephone that may not have that would not have seen those questions, if you could read those questions and then respond to those, and then we'll go on with other questions.
Okay, thanks, Peter. So one question came through when we were talking about employment statistics, if this includes both white-collar and blue-collar jobs, and the statistic does. Employment statistics report on all workforce employment. The second question was, how can organizations make sure they include disability in their diversity and inclusion statements without expressly asking their employees if they have a disability, and without forcing their employees to disclose their disabilities without consent? And what we were talking about today was that disability should be included in diversity, similarly to other diverse categories such as gender and race, regardless of if someone identifies as having a disability or not. Disability is one of those top eight categories of diversity. And so good practice is including it. Employees should never have to disclose or self-identify if they don't want to. And another question was, what would be the best process to suggest creating a community of practice in our area? Would it be better to have it led by the local government or one of the disability community organizations? And we responded. I'll hand over to Rob for the response on community of practice, Rob, because there's two questions.
Sure. We had a few people write in about questions regarding communities of practice. Most of the participants in our interviews suggested starting with a business and a connection to the disability community, whether it's an advocacy group, a center for independent living, or some sort of service provider-related agency. Government often tends to be seen as a way to get information and resources, and generally they were brought in later to start in identifying potential employees. Some of our states specifically mentioned with working with workforce development systems, but rarely were they starting points for these communities of practice. A second question was that when you mentioned communities of practice, tapping into regional resources such as universities, what does that tapping look like? Is it mostly recruitment? The answer to that is not entirely recruitment. One strategy that we've seen absolutely is recruitment, connecting with the job fairs on campuses throughout the region is a prominent strategy. Oftentimes looking at specific universities as well. A few were mentioned that have kind of vibrant areas of disability inclusion and culture. One way to start would be looking at universities that actually have devoted resources to disability culture. In addition to disability resource centers, there's an increasing movement in university settings to actually have student centers for disability culture, which are not just ways to get potential recruitments, but also to really learn about other people passionate about disability inclusion. These often are hubs for both students with disabilities as cultural partners to come together to learn more about each other. The last question... Not the last question, but one additional question that we had from the web was, where do we actually find the CSR reports online? It's a great question and something that I forgot to mention. The CSR reports are available through our recent publication. Just this month, we came out with the initial findings of our review of CSR strategies in the Journal of Vocational Rehabilitation. In that publication includes all of the companies that were included in our sample through the analysis of CSR. That publication will be posted, a link will be posted on the Great Lakes site, and you can contact me if you want additional information about how to access that publication.
Hey, Robin, what is the acronym, CSR?
Thank you. CSR stands for Corporate social responsibility.
All right, thank you. Do you want to let's move on. We've got some more questions that were submitted online. Let me before we get to those, let me ask you the sort of a big picture question in the research. You talk about that there needs to be a top down approach. To really move the needle. How can that be done, versus, it being a company by company basis that, someone has a relation to disability, either themselves or, a family member or a friend. How does that needle really move to increase, the employment rate of people with disabilities when you're potentially looking at it, going on, business by business or company, by company, if that makes sense.
Thanks for that question. This is Rob still speaking, and that's a great question about how we can really move the needle forward. One of the ideas that we've really garnered from this research process is that identifying a champion often includes allies and includes a broader range than just people with disabilities. It also includes family members, and it often includes some sort of permanent structure or support so that it's actually maintained and not just sort of like a one-off flame. So usually this means some sort of direct allocation of resources. As we mentioned, very few of these companies actually had a specific person in charge of disability inclusion, although some did, but almost all of them had some sort of static resource, usually even if it's a small budget for an employee group to actually maintain their meetings and actually continue these ongoing conversations. To really move the needle, I think that these groups cannot exist within their own organization. It was really kind of strived across all the interviewees that these groups grow when businesses talk to each other. Coming back to that question on communities of practice, even though I think it's essential that disability advocacy groups as well as governments get involved with this process, actually getting the buy-in from businesses themselves is a huge starting point. Often it takes that sort of deep personal connection, whether it's one's own identity or their family, to really move it forward. But we hope that that can be an example of leadership in the future.
Great. Thank you for that, Rob. And just a sort of, follow-up question. I think I'm accurate when, the research, talked about, corporations with, I think you said 5,000 or more employees. And I think over half of the workforce are, employed by small employers, which the Small Business Administration, defines as employers with, I think, 500 or fewer employees. So any thoughts on, taking, what you've learned from this, looking at larger corporations and what they're doing and what can be done there, and how do we, the collective we, how does that information get to smaller employers that are actually, employing more people on a percentage basis across the country?
Absolutely. Great question. The focus point of our study obviously was what we might consider large businesses, even though there's a huge range of what a large business means. It can be anything from 5,000 to 500,000 employees, although we didn't get to any businesses that big. We did try and ask those questions about what happens when you're just starting off. One of the key takeaways I would say is what were identified as employee resource groups within the big businesses can actually mean a lot of different things, especially to those medium or small size groups. Oftentimes, employee resource groups can be more kind of informal settings, those that really welcome some sort of partnership and employee-to-employee dialogue. They might be kind of a, quote, safe space to actually have those conversations about what companies need to do. What's really neat about some of the businesses we've identified as they've become kind of leaders in disability inclusive efforts, these employee resource groups are increasingly becoming more public in their engagement. They speak to each other and can actually be great resources to speak to some of the smaller businesses about how they've been included within their workspace. Especially some of those small businesses you're talking about, Peter, might not have the resources for a formal employee group, or you might not even have multiple employees. So tapping into what already exists, especially those existing community of practices, may be a more relevant starting point.
Excellent. Thanks again for that, Rob. Curious about the, you know, your research, and you know, we know that the, you know, the largest generation in U.S. history, the baby boom generation, you know, folks are retiring from that generation. There was a slowdown in people from that age group retiring when, you know, back in the early 2000s, you know, when we had the economic slowdown, but, you know, folks are beginning to retire again. So was there any recognition, acknowledgement that you know, the pool of people with disabilities, the nearly 70% of people with disabilities that are not employed, you know, what role that group can play in filling the void as baby boomers, you know, retire, in larger numbers, you know, it's sort of, you know, I guess that would be the, you know, the business, you know, case of, you know, for recruiting, attracting, and keeping employees, people with disabilities.
Yes, this is Sarah. There was a discussion by the people that we spoke to. There's a recognition that the workforce is changing, and the workforce that is coming through to replace some of the retiring workforce and the aging workforce isn't there in the same levels that companies are used to seeing. And so looking towards people with disabilities, given that there is such a high percentage of people with disabilities that are unemployed, that want to be employed, that have the qualifications to be employed, that could, you know, with training, have additional qualifications to also be employed, are ready to work and want to work. And so there's a recognition, the companies that we spoke to, because they really want to work on disability inclusion efforts, they are starting to look at people with disabilities as an untapped source of potential recruiting, hiring, and then also retaining people with disabilities in the workforce. So I do think that this is, as you said, Peter, this is the business case in that you have a whole population that is ready and willing to work, and, you know, we can create the environment in which they can be successful.
Great. Thanks. And then just a sort of follow-up on that. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning, we're, you know, rapidly approaching the 30th anniversary of the signing of the ADA, and the employment numbers are, you know, roughly the same as they were, you know, 30 years ago. And then some may look at that as, you know, the ADA has been a, you know, a failure in the employment context. And it, as we know, you know, participating today, that, you know, the ADA is only one piece to the employment puzzle. There are lots of other things that go into employment, education, and you know, volunteer, and those first job opportunities for people with disabilities. So, in your research, or just thoughts in general about, you know, that looking at the ADA as a law that requires equal opportunity, you know, is there a recognition amongst your, you know, through your research that, you know, the ADA is you know, a compliance piece, a federal compliance law, and that, you know, in order, and really the real need to, you know, increase the number of employees with disabilities, you know, takes, you know, policy development and some of that, you know, that peer-to-peer, business-to-business, discussion, you know, such as disability in.
Thanks, Peter. That's a good question. More broadly, outside of our research, I do think that there is a perception, what employment research in general has shown, is that there is a perception by employees to see ADA, not all employees, but by many employees, to see ADA as compliance, and so doing the minimal level of the law. I do also at the same time see through the research that there is this commitment to the broader spirit of the ADA, to this piece around equality of opportunity and moving beyond the law to true inclusive practices. And then in terms of our research, interestingly, very few people actually spoke about the context of the ADA as being something that was a driving point to either make change, cultural or systemic change, or compliance change, or not making cultural, systemic, or compliance change.
This is Rob. I'd like to add a little bit about that in terms of the interviewees' responses. It was very interesting to hear, even though very few participants specifically mentioned the ADA, many of the goals of the ADA, such as full participation and equal opportunity, were kind of the key ideas as well as phrases that were echoed throughout all of the participants. In one of our other research projects, where we looked at the impact of information on the ADA and actually creating a culture of compliance, we found that oftentimes attitudinal change requires more than just information about the law, but it actually has to include more of the social goals and the cultural impact, as well as the story about the ADA as a cornerstone of civil rights legislation and its connection to disability advocacy, as well as people with disabilities and their claiming of rights. So I think it was really interesting to see in our interviewees who are really picking up on some of those larger social goals of the ADA, as rather than just the issues of compliance, which I think really speaks to how we might move forward, moving beyond the culture of compliance for the 30th anniversary. We've had a number of questions come in from the web. Even though we might not get a chance to get all of them, we encourage you, especially if some of the folks asking for very practical resources, we're happy to give some referrals, including some people asked for tools for looking at disability etiquette, as well as small workplace inclusive options. A number of resources are available through the Great Lakes ADA Center online, and they also, one of the other services that we offer through the toll-free hotline is connections to other groups as needed. Another question that came in on the web recently was asking about the CSR reports, the corporate social responsibility reports, and asking, is it public information which businesses have tools like community practices, employee resource groups, and senior leadership buy-in? While oftentimes the reports will advocate these ideas of strategy, we found that very rarely did the CSR reports actually specify having these tools. Employee resource groups were the one exception. Those frequently are mentioned as a strategy for CSR, but very rarely was it gone into in-depth about what that group looked like. Oftentimes it was more in a kind of checklist item related to other groups and employee infinity groups that might be available.
Just real quick, Rob, also for folks, outside of the Great Lakes region, you can reach, your regional ADA center, and they have information such as questions regarding small business, and they can provide you information about the small business tax credit, that can assist with employee accommodations as well as, ensuring effective communication with customers with disabilities. So, again, adata.org is where you can find your regional ADA center. So, sorry, go ahead, Rob.
Thanks for sharing some more information about that, Peter. A two-headed monster, not just research, but also practice. Another question that just came in online was, do you have examples of training approaches that incorporate disability into diversity and inclusion training, specifically racial equity training? The participant online is working with organizations that want to address it all at once, which I think is a really innovative way of looking at disability and actually embedding it within the category of diversity. Short answer is, unfortunately, we don't have any great examples ourselves. I think this is one of the times that we really would refer back to those business-to-business types of links and communities of practice. Disability In would be a great starting point to think about both the national level to try and locate some of those trainings as well as potential trainers. There are a lot of great trainers out there, but actually standardized approaches, I don't think we're very familiar with them, honestly. Thank you for those questions.
Okay, excellent. And Lovely, let's check real quick, see if we have any questions on the telephone at this time.
There are no further questions at this time, sir.
All right, great. Rob, Sarah, Courtney, through the research, is there any particular industry that's doing a better job, or just in general your knowledge and research in the area of it, employment of people with disabilities? Is there one industry, healthcare, hospitality that may be doing better than others?
That's a really interesting question, Peter. I don't really think we could say one is doing a better job than other. One of the most prominent was definitely healthcare, because I think it's maybe easiest to see that clear link between maybe the patient experience as well as the employee experience. And it's often easy to kind of see those, similarities in building a more inclusive and accessible environment. Most of our sample was really representative of the Great Lakes region, as well as a lot of the businesses that call Great Lakes home, especially related to various financial services and insurance. A lot of those types of industries tend to be more prevalent within the Great Lakes. Besides the healthcare, I don't think we can really say that one group is leading the pathway in terms of the industries.
Thanks, Rob. And there was a question that came in about, is there a federal requirement for employers to report the number or percentages of employees with disabilities? There's nothing for private employers under the ADA or any other federal law. For federal contractors and federal subcontractors, there are rules under through the U.S. Department of Labor that apply. There are targeted hiring rates for federal contractors and subcontractors of 7%. For individuals with disabilities, but in the private sector, there's no requirement for reporting that data. A question about we talked about the top down approach. Do you have any examples or thoughts on where disability diversity where it started somewhere down the chain where someone, a mid manager, supervisor, or even an employee was able to work that message the opposite direction within a company or corporation?
Yeah, so I guess the question is kind of was sometimes more from the grassroots or from a middle management instead of that top down. Even though kind of all of these groups explained that the continued success and longevity really needed that top level buy-in, pretty much all these groups usually started with just one person, sometimes two people coming together, usually a person with a disability themselves, or a person who is a parent of a child with disability, and oftentimes it started with just one person bringing it as an idea, especially if they had some sort of report in hand. A lot of people mentioned using the resources of Disability In as a starting point just to approach top-level management, but even all of these really large organizations started with one individual champion. As we talked about, for sustainability, that person can't do it all. And luckily, each of these groups mentioned that it became a larger community, especially when the top level comes in, especially when you have top level actually disclosing and talking about the relationship to disability. It can be a great way of spreading that culture of inclusion throughout the organization. Sarah's going to talk a little bit more about that process as well.
Thanks, Rob. So also linking to a question that came through, which said, some of the benefits you list include self-identification efforts. How do self-identification efforts benefit workplace culture in general and employees with disabilities? And just to link that to what Rob was saying and back to the question, Peter, what is different, particularly when you see employee resource groups in organizations, is that for disability, it doesn't just include the diversity identity that is the focus. It also includes parents, siblings, allies, as well as people with disabilities themselves. And I think that's the richness of disability in the workplace, where it doesn't have to be one person with a disability being the champion. The champion can actually come from different areas and different sources. But quickly, and this is what our participants in the interviews talked about, very quickly you can see this network that gets built where people have an interest in disability because they're touched by disability in some way, whether it's personal, whether it's an ally, or whether it's just broader part of, being part of a society. When it comes to self-identification efforts, what has been shown to be successful is that when there are self-identification campaigns where people can actually self-identify as disabled in safe environments, it builds allyship and it builds a coalition where disability just becomes an everyday part of the workplace alongside every other category. For some people with disabilities, they don't have a choice whether to self-identify if they have visible disabilities. And even with people with visible disabilities, they may not identify as being disabled. And then people with invisible disabilities don't have that choice or may not have that choice or may not want to identify. And so a self-identification campaign can actually bring together a range of people with different kinds of disabilities that can work together in a coalition. And when you have that senior leadership buy-in, and some of the organizations spoke about this, when a senior leader or even a manager, a middle-level manager, identified themselves or a family member or an ally identified, then it actually helped everybody else feel supported to also identify in a safe environment. And self-identification is also different than the process of identifying for disclosing for the purpose of accommodation. So just to backtrack one part to make sure we're on the same page, self-identification is around self-identifying as a disability from a cultural perspective, to be part of a disability culture and a disability community and a disability coalition within a workplace. And this is different than people who want to self-disclose for the purpose of receiving accommodations. Sometimes it ends up that they're the same outcome. Someone will identify for the purpose of an accommodation and then also be part of a culture. Some people will culturally identify without the need for accommodation, but then also that might bring up, well, what else do you need, you know, to help support you in the workplace?
Great. Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, Robin. And as you were answering there, a question popped in my head, and I know you're cringing. But going back to the baby boomers, again, as part of the research or just your research, you know, on the ADA and employment, you know, how are employers, you know, working with employees from that generation that may have functional limitations that, you know, meet the definition of disability under the ADA, but they're not going to identify, you know, as being a person with a disability. And the minute you mention ADA or accommodations, you know, they want nothing to, you know, to do with that. So it may be a different researcher project, but, you know, any thoughts on how, you know, employers, you know, are doing that? Because you obviously want to retain employees that have been with you for a long period of time, especially if it, you know, means, you know, simply providing a larger screen or, you know, some modification or adaptation in the workplace. So any thoughts or any of that come across in your interviews?
Great question. And, you know, it did in some ways. One thing, I guess, I don't want people coming out of here thinking that the companies we worked with are all roses. They all spoke with kind of some challenges that they face in really promoting disability inclusion, especially with that self-identification piece. One way that kind of organizations are promoting moving forward is really become that senior level buy-in from people that are maybe close to retirement, actually talking about accommodation process and talking about how they've benefited from aspects of disability inclusion. One interesting finding was that even though many of the kind of senior level folks didn't necessarily openly say that they're a person with a disability, but their willingness to actually approach these conversations is seen as a starting point. One of the challenges that a number of our individuals specifically talked about was related to mental health conditions, which tends to be one of those groups that is not necessarily being identified well with a lot of self-identification campaigns. It's important to think when we're talking about disability, it's a really broad range of people receiving different types of supports. I think the next step and one of the challenges is to really think about how we might be inclusive of some of those folks that are more on the margins.
Excellent. Thanks for that, Rob.
I wanted to add on to that.
Go ahead, Courtney.
Peter, this is Courtney. So looking at some of the other literature in the background is when organizations have some of the strategies that we've talked about, that such as accommodation, when you have a set accommodation practices, it doesn't only apply to people who identify as having a disability. So thinking about some of those strategies that Rob talked about at the beginning of our presentation with flexible management, et cetera, that can be applied to a much broader group of employees that I think addresses some of the ideas that you were suggesting with the aging workforce.
Yeah, and a great point, Courtney. And you know, employers could benefit from policies that, you know, every request for doing something differently isn't necessarily treated as an ADA and request for documentation. You know, lots of people want different types of chairs. You know, if that makes a person more comfortable and more productive, then, you know, by all means, provide it to them. Or if someone, you know, needs a different piece of computer, a bigger screen or two screens, you know, maybe instead of making it a formal accommodation process, they, you know, the employer, you know, provides it to the employee. We're almost at the bottom of the hour, so just a, you know, last question. A lot of our participants, some of our participants are from the disability community, advocates, service providers. You know, how can folks from the disability community, you know, disability advocates, you know, use this information, you know, from working from the other side to get businesses to drive, you know, employment of people with disabilities within their communities?
I think one thing, first off, is to remember that all people are consumers, and businesses really that are doing well are mindful that oftentimes they overlook certain groups that are consumers, that they want to make really good practices, not just internally to their organizations, but in terms of any product, and I say that term loosely, any product that they're delivering, whether it be healthcare, financial services, accounting services, whether it's a shop selling goods, online businesses as well.
A second point, this is Rob, is to really remember some of the key points of what are making these businesses thrive. Actually, looking at making the business case for disability inclusion. None of these businesses are working with service providers as a matter of charity or you know, pity. It's really about doing the right thing to promote inclusive business practices. So actually, when service providers can really try and make that case of how individuals fit within the broader goals of an untapped market, I think that's where service providers can really start making that better connection to the business community.
All right. Excellent. We are near the bottom of the hour and near our stop time. So I want to thank Sarah, Rob, and Courtney for joining us today, and not just for the 90-plus minutes they spent with us today, but the time in putting together their presentation. We truly appreciate that. Want to remind folks that, you know, again, the contact information for Rob, Sarah, and Courtney, or Rob's contact information is in the handout information that will be posted with the archive approximately 48 hours after today's session. That information will be made available. For some of those resources we were talking about, you can reach your regional ADA center, 800-949-4232, or visit the National Network website, adata.org, and find your regional ADA center. As a reminder, our next ADA audio conference session will be coming up on Tuesday, March the 17th, where we will be looking at accessible polling facilities in the ADA, just in time for a lot of the primaries that are taking place and then our general election in the fall. So join us as Julie Brinkoff, who is the co-director of the Great Plains ADA Center, will be presenting on that session. You can find a full description of that session register for that by visiting the ADA Audio Conference website, ada-audio.org. As a reminder, today's session has been recorded. The audio archive, along with the materials, will be available. An edited transcript of today's session will be available in approximately 3 weeks' time. So, again, thanks to our presenters, and most of all, thanks to all of you for joining us today. I encourage you to complete the evaluations for today's session. That helps us plan future sessions and identify the topics and information that you want to see us present in the future. So thanks again, everyone, for joining us. Enjoy the remainder of your Tuesday, and good day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect. Speakers, please stay for a post-conference.